Hello and welcome to Slycast, the Sylvester Stallone fan podcast. I'm Craig Cohen, and as always, I have with me Jeff Ferry.
You're the disease, and I'm the cure.
And Jeff Hewlett.
I want your eyes, Craig. Oh,
no. After the broadcast, please. So, guys, as you can tell, this episode we're going to be talking about 1986's Cobra, and I know it's a movie that we've been waiting to talk about, and that the listeners have been waiting to talk about it. And before we get started, I want to talk about the listeners because we've got so many great people we're interacting with over at the Slycast page on Facebook. It's facebook.com/theslycast. And I just want to say hi to all the people that have interacted with us over there. We've got Steve Ricardo. Forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, but Seiko Hearsink. And then Matt from Rambo Mania, who I want to talk about. And Matt devoted an entire episode of his show to sort of giving us the rub, if you will. And if it's not obvious from the name, what Matt is doing over there is a show devoted completely to all things Rambo. So if you can't get enough of our Rambo talk, please check out Rambo Mania. It's under the Studio Red Band account over at YouTube, and I will include the notes or the link in the show notes. But a big thanks to Matt for the for his kind words, and I know Jeff Hewlett, you were really moved by his episode enough to leave some comments on the YouTube page.
Yeah, you know, when I listened to that or watched that episode on YouTube, I when it was over, I was just kind of taken aback by, you know, this was kind of a. I don't know if the listeners are aware of how this project started for the three of us, but it was kind of almost a goof at the beginning. And, you know, it was a part of a different podcast network's page. And we were all posting about, you know, the Slycast and making a goof about it, starting up a podcast because we're all Sly fans. And, you know, to know that what we're doing here and the fact that we love Sly and his movies so much, And you know, what we're doing with our coverage in the Slycast is having such an effect on such an obvious fan of Stallone. It really hit home for me, and I realized that we're doing something great here. And I think that all of us, we may not be taking this seriously enough. And I think that this has had such a broad impact. And I think it's just such a great thing that the affirmation that we got. Yep. From that episode. And I feel so great about what we're doing. I feel like that one boost was enough to affirm how I felt about what we're doing.
Right on. And the other cool thing about it is seeing how we're all sort of connected in the Stallone fan universe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Matt's doing something completely different than us that sort of really puts a microscope on one aspect of Stallone's career, which is just really, really excellent. And he's done some interviews. He's spoken with David Morrell, the author of First Blood. He's spoken to some of the actors. So definitely check that out. And thank you, Matt, so much for showcasing our show. And we are happy to showcase yours. And Jeff, it's funny that you mentioned the response. I was looking at some of our iTunes reviews, and we got one from Mink Hollow. It's a 5-star review. And it reads, Craig and a couple of Jeffs are truly creating a podcast that is enthusiastic for Stallone's body of work. It is downright contagious to hear them wax eloquent and then realize just how many great Sly movies I've missed and need to see. Definitely subscribe if you're a 70s, 80s film fan, because these movies were very often at the epicenter of that era. So that kind of speaks to what you said in terms of really showcasing movies out there that people might be overlooking, especially some of the early stuff in his career.
Yes.
Jeff Ferry, any feelings on that review?
I mean, it's a tremendous review, and it definitely points out that, like, depending on your age, it may point out which Sly movies you're really into, which we've already discovered on this show. Like, to a lot of us, like, that mid-80s is, like, really the Stallone's, like, that's where the meat of his stuff is. But there's a lot of people out right now that are just, you know, they're just starting to discover the Expendables.
Yeah.
And that's how they know. They know the old Stallone, but they may not have seen the Cobras of the world or the Over the Tops.
Yep.
Yeah, very cool. And that's one of the great things about sort of when you have any actor that has a huge body of work is there's people that have sort of their era that they like. And then there's people that sort of appreciate or celebrate, if you will, the entire catalog, like we do here over at the Slycast. So since we last talked, guys, there's been some exciting stuff that's happened in the world of Sylvester Stallone. There had been rumblings for years about a follow-up to Rambo, and for our purposes, we'll call it Rambo 4, which I feel, and I know Jeff Hewlett has similar feelings, was really a great last or final entry in the series. But we learned last month that later this month, down in Louisiana, Stallone is going to be starting what is tentatively called Rambo Last Blood. And we don't know much about it aside from the fact that his rumored Rambo versus a Mexican drug cartel plot is what they seem to be going with. And this is the exciting part for me, Stallone will be behind the camera directing, which is something he hasn't done since the first Expendables movies. So, yeah. Jeff Ferry, overall, your feelings on Stallone Last Blood and your feelings on how that might or might not impact Rambo 4.
Well, when the last Rambo came out, you know, we had to go through all the jokes then too about, oh, who's he going to fight this time? Is he going to fight his prostate? Blah, blah, blah. And despite what I saw on our Facebook page, I really enjoyed the last one. I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. Like you, I thought it was, if this was the last one, I'd have been happy with it. This is a character that, as far as I'm concerned, he can revisit and revisit and revisit. I mean, it's Rambo. It's not like he would – I mean, he's not going to ruin the character.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
if I had my choice, if he's going to go back and revisit Rambo or Rocky, I prefer he just stayed with Rambo at this point.
Well, yeah, because Rambo's really a character that can age. And, you know, he might slow down a little bit, but – you know, we were really stretching the limits of what Rocky could do by putting Rocky in a boxing ring in his mid to late 50s. Whereas Rambo, you know, we've seen with Clint Eastwood, you can be in your 70s and you know, you can still be tough. So, yeah, the thing for me is that last movie ended with such a great image of him walking up that long trail to his family's property in Arizona. And it just seemed like such a fitting end. And I think out of the two characters, Rocky and Rambo, both really needed a final entry to sort of create a nice bookend for that character. So I hope he can really just make a movie that doesn't really undo that really effective ending that Part 4 had. Jeff Hewlett.
You know, the thing that I'm really happy about is that, you know, for a while we had heard these rumors that the next Rambo movie would be Rambo fighting some sort of like a mythical beast or right? Remember that?
Yeah, he had optioned a book, a kind of a sci-fi book called, I think, The Hunter. And it was really scary for a while because he was pretty gung-ho about it. And it was going to be
so nervous.
Rambo against it was almost like Rambo meets Predator.
Right. Yeah. And I was so nervous when I saw that. I was like, this is going to be just a complete derailment. Even if you take out, you know, Part 3, which is what a lot of people have an issue with. It just seemed like such a strange departure for the Rambo series. Now to hear that he's going to be going up against a Mexican drug cartel, which is actually pretty topical, knowing all of the problems that have been going on in Mexico with the drug cartels and tourists and travelers, you know, being kidnapped and whatnot. This sounds like, once again, a topical conversation for Rambo to address, which is something that he's done in the past. And I'm so relieved to hear that. I can't wait to see what Sly's got up his sleeve for this movie.
Yeah, and the other neat thing is he's going to sort of be back on his home turf, if you will, which is, we haven't seen him there since, I guess, the very beginning of First Blood Part 2, where they don't really say where he is, but he was imprisoned. But, you know, he'll be back on, I guess, North American soil, at least.
Right.
So, I don't know. I'm really happy to see that he's directing it, though, because I understand that the Expendable movies got to a certain size and possibly got away from him in terms of his ability as a director. But I think Stallone really understands the Rambo character.
Yeah.
And as funny as this sounds, I think he understands the Rambo character even more than the man who created him, author David Morrell. And And I think David Morrell would probably agree with us here in the sense that the cinematic Rambo, nobody really does know him better than Stallone. So I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about Last Blood as it gets closer and closer to in its production and its ultimate release. So we'll be sharing any of that info on Facebook and any of our introductions on the shows from this point forward. So, guys, are you ready to talk 1986's Cobra?
Totally.
Absolutely.
All right. So it came out May 23rd, 1986. It opened number one the weekend it came out on a budget of $25 million. It made globally $160 million, 49 of that here in the States. So a respectable haul. I'm not sure if that was in line with what they were really expecting from Stallone, considering his drawing power. But if we look back and we've seen his trend, if it's not a Rambo or a Rocky movie, they're not making as much. So looking at the numbers here, I'm really surprised we never got a sequel to Cobra. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. Directed by George P. Cosmatos, who also directed Stallone in First Blood Part 2. And the screenplay is by Stallone, based on a novel called Fair Game by Paula Gosling, which is kind of interesting because it was a novel she wrote in 1978 called A Running Duck. And she optioned it to Warner Brothers for a mid-five-figure sum and then forgot about it. And it wasn't until one of her friend's son went to the movies and saw a preview for Cobra and saw Gosling's name in the credits. So oh, she never – so here's a quote from her that was in People magazine the year the film came out. I guess they figure they give you the money and that's that, she says. Gosling has never met Stallone, has never been to Hollywood, and has not even been invited to a screening of the movie. But any hard feelings about the snub should be soothed by her financial gain. In addition to the box office bounty, she'll receive another round of royalties when the book is sold in the U.S. as Fair Game and reissued in Britain under its original name, along with the cover blurb, now filmed as Cobra. So that's pretty funny. And that same novel under the title of Fair Game was remade in the 90s with Cindy Crawford and a Baldwin brother as Fair Game. So I haven't really seen that moving a long time, but it's pretty much a supermodel on the run, and I think that's where the similarities end. Yep. Either guy, one of you guys remember that movie?
Vaguely.
Yes, it's a pile of garbage.
I do remember, like, Cindy Crawford and the Baldwin brother, like, almost having sex on, like, a moving train.
They don't know. Well, I mean, yes, and then she shoots somebody. Yes. I remember that part, too. It's a Baldwin brother, and it's not even Alec.
Yeah, and that pretty much started and ended Cindy Crawford's career.
Was it Steven?
No, I think it was Billy.
It was William, I think.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Even going lower on the food chain.
At least it wasn't Daniel.
Oh, goodness. So that's some interesting backstory there. Now, Jeff Hewlett, before we get in the movie, I know you're a big fan of Cobra. I know when we do our ranking of all the Stallone films, I'd be shocked if this doesn't rank very, very high. And if you're up for it, I don't want to put you on the spot. Do you want to walk us through the movie tonight?
Wow. That's huge. I would be glad to give it a shot. I don't know if I can, I can sub in for the legendary Craig Cohen, but I'll give it a try.
I'm sure you're going to do great. And thank you for the kind words.
Well, I will give it my best shot. What do you think, Jeff Ferry?
I mean, I guess you're all right.
I thought he was going to say go for it.
Well, that's Rocky, so yeah. We haven't covered Rocky V yet, so a little bit different. But all right, well, I will give it my best shot. And, you know, one thing that I really loved about Cobra is that it has a very different opening than we're used to watching other Stallone films. This one kind of begins with a monologue from Stallone's character, and he's kind of running down some crime statistics. I guess we're supposed to understand that there's a certain amount of rapes and murders that happen every so often, but we don't really get an actual introduction to his character through that opening sequence. We see the snake head on the gun handle, and we see a silhouette of a motorcycle rider, and we see some really strange images of what we, I guess we have to take away is that it's some sort of a cult. We see people like banging axes together, and strangely, there's some guys in business suits mixed in the crowd there.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like showing that there. It's weird because you've got this like this. It seems like there's two different sects of this gang. You've got the motorcycle unit, and then you've got like the suit and tie unit.
Yeah, I guess we're supposed to understand that this is a gang or a group of people who are from different walks of life but are unified to a single cause, the cause we won't understand until later in the movie. But I guess this opening sequence is supposed to show us a little bit about Stallone's character versus the gang itself. Jeff Ferry, do you have any thoughts on this opening sequence?
As I previously discussed with you guys, I think over Facebook, it's if you just wandered into the room and this was playing, you would think it was the trailer for Cobra.
Yeah.
Because you see the silhouette, the gun, you see a little bit of the bad guys, and he's going through. There's a rape every 54 minutes. There's a and like I'm waiting for the end of it instead of it breaking into the movie for it to be like Cobra coming this fall. But I mean, you got to leave it to Stallone. Only Stallone would have the cojones to have a montage. Open his movie.
Yeah.
That takes a special kind of director right there, or a special kind of writer, to be like, you know what, I'm just going to start with a montage.
Yeah, and apparently I did a little bit of research here, and there was a much longer, a close to 2-hour cut of this movie. But apparently, as they got close to release, they were worried that Top Gun, which had just opened and had been very successful, was going to be troublesome in terms of their ticket sales. So in order to get in an extra showtime, they cut nearly 40 minutes out of the movie to, you know, to squeeze another showtime in and get some extra ticket sales. So wow. I'm not entirely sure how true that is, but if anybody could creatively go into their movie and sort of montage it up and bring it in under 90 minutes, Stallone's definitely your guy.
Wow, that you know, I'm imagining that that's probably true or close to the truth, and I think that overall the movie may have been better for being a little bit longer. And I as we discuss this, I'm sure we'll tackle all of those questions. But this movie, I think, is very front-loaded. And I think this supermarket scene that opens the film is pretty indicative of that, that we get introduced to Stallone's character, and we're also sort of saddled with being introduced to this cult, but in a strange way, with a sort of a vigilante or a little evil doer kind of guy, where we're shown a supermarket in some sort of a city an urban area in within a city, and we've got a guy who's kind of shady in a trench coat, and he kind of rolls up on a motorcycle, and he winds up pulling out a shotgun and shooting up a supermarket. You got a lot of people in there who are, you know, doing their daily shopping, and he's, you know, blowing away the groceries around them and winds up taking some hostages. This is before Stallone himself shows up. And I know Craig and I have been goofing a lot lately about some of the lines that this guy says. So I want to let Craig Cohen talk a little bit about the introduction to the supermarket scene and how the audience is led into this film.
It almost seems to me like this guy is possibly, this is almost maybe like an initiation where the gang had sent him out and said, okay, you know, your task is to go to the supermarket and spread the word over TV. So I'm not sure, you know, he's definitely charismatic because he's got some great lines when Cobra finally shows up. You know, he talks about being a hunter and part of the new world.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of really stylistic things going here, filmmaking wise. You know, you got a lot of slow motion, shopping cart explosion.
And, yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden this, you know, this bright supermarket turns sort of into this, you know, Hollywood, the stylized Hollywood soundstage almost. You know, you've got the frozen food aisles with the smoke and the dark light. And then tons of product placement. You got Coors, you got Pepsi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you've got the guy that the evildoer, for lack of a better word, comes across, and he says he's free. The guy starts walking away, and then he finally starts running, and he gets shot in the back. I didn't understand what exactly happened there.
Yeah, that didn't really get a heck of a lot of explanation. And, you know, I've seen this movie so many times, and through the goggles of more modern movies, I kind of almost wanted to think that this guy was like an early day Danny Trejo in a way, right? So, Jeff Ferry, what are your thoughts on the initial part of the opening supermarket scene?
It's very strange because he comes in and it's like he doesn't quite know what he wants. Like, he comes in and he opens fire and he's got a Hong Kong shotgun, so he can shoot it as much as he wants to and it will never run out of ammo.
Right.
So, like, but I mean, all he's doing is blowing produce away. Produce blowing away, blows away like some milk. He shoots the shopping cart that's full of explosives. And like Craig says, the first guy he kills is the guy that's like, okay, let you go. It's like he realized at some point, like, well, I guess I got to kill somebody if they're going to take me seriously. And I mean, he shoots the guy from pretty far away with a very sawed off shotgun. I'm not even sure if that guy would be dead. He just might be like, ow, I just got hit with some pellets.
So things progress pretty quickly, and all of a sudden there are police officers outside of the supermarket, and someone calls the Cobra. The order goes out, right? The Cobra is called, and not long after, we see what I think is a pretty awesome car, and the license plate actually reflects that, a pretty awesome car speeding into the parking lot with a license plate that reads Awesome 50. Spelled AWSOM 50. That is the introduction of Stallone's character, Cobra. And, you know, this whole sequence is meant to introduce us to the cult itself and Cobra's character, along with some of the other police officers who were involved in this movie throughout the course. And things that we get to learn about Cobra through this opening scene is, you know, he shows up, he's chewing on a matchstick, and he's sort of he stands out on his own. The other cops are a little bit uncomfortable with his methods, but he's sort of I don't know if he's necessarily a vigilante in a way, but he's part of a different squad of the police department, and they call him into these types of situations, and he winds up going in there by himself. He doesn't have any sort of bulletproof vests on or anything. He goes in there just, with the clothes he drove in with. And he's sort of sent in there to deal with this vigilante and the hostage situation that's going on here. And, you know, normally in everyday life, we see the SWAT team is called in and you have a whole bunch of guys in bulletproof vests. But in this universe, we see Stallone going in on his own to take out this vigilante on a one-on-one sort of method. And, we get no backstory at all on his character. He just kind of shows up. And he does a couple of interesting things as he walks into the supermarket. He winds up cracking a beer and drinking a little bit of that Coors that Craig mentioned earlier. And, I'm going to stop here before we get to the actual confrontation between Cobra and this cult member. And do you guys feel that we may have been better off with more of a backstory on his character, or do you feel that introducing him in this way was effective? Jeff Ferry?
I'm going to say that I really enjoy the way that they do it. I could see Stallone's fingerprints on this type of thing, because he's more of the school of, I don't want to tell you, I'm going to show you. He pulls up in his car, which is an obvious cop movie car that no cop would ever own.
Right.
He gets out with the leather jacket and the sunglasses, the matchstick. You see him talking to the other cops. You don't need a backstory on him. You know what's going on. It's like when you see Batman, do you need a backstory? No, you're pretty sure this guy has some problems to get to this point. Like, I don't need to know. Like, I'm guessing in the hour or the 40-minute longer cut, there's probably 10 minutes about his backstory that I honestly don't care about. He pulls up in the car. He gets out. He talks to the three cops. And just the interaction he has with those three, the one that's his friend, the one that's his boss, and the one that hates him. You get everything you need there. And once he heads in, you see how he acts. Like, that's all you needed. He summed up. And this is what Stallone is so great at. He summed up what could have been 10 minutes of boring exposition into 45 seconds of a character pulling up in a car.
Wow, excellent summation. Craig Cohen, anything to add?
Yeah, totally. And he uses other characters to do that as well. You've got, Detective Monty, played by Andrew Robinson, which is great casting. Andrew Robinson played the killer in the original Dirty Harry. So I thought that was kind of an interesting casting choice. And right out of the gate, you can tell that this sort of stuffy, you know, wimpy looking cop or detective doesn't like Cobra. And you get a lot of information just from his reaction. So it's a great tool that Stallone used there, where you have a character reacting to another character, which kind of really sells some of the history there. So I think, you know, having sort of this introduction is really perfect, because it also really makes Cobra feel like, you know, Jeff Ferry talked about Batman. It really kind of makes Cobra feel like a superhero.
Oh, you know, that's excellent. I'm really glad that you said that. You guys kind of both arrived at that conclusion, because I think that's kind of where the movie was pushing the viewers to think, is that this is this guy, this character is almost superhuman in a way. And I think the rest of the scene that plays out in the supermarket sort of supports that. And one other thing that I wanted to bring up as we get through the rest of the scene is this sequence almost it sets the stage for other action movies in the 80s that followed this or occurred around the same time. And it sets up the hero, or the dark hero of the movie, with all of these great one-liners. And it seems like in other movies seem to imitate this. And I think the supermarket sequence really encapsulates very well that sort of a motif going forward. And you've got Sly confronting this guy that's got these people captured around this this cold case. And he's sort of egging him on. Sly gets around to the PA system and starts to taunt the guy, calling him a lousy shot. But, you know, he throws out a couple of one-liners. One of them is, you know, you wasted a kid, now it's time to waste you. And the guy claims he has a bomb. And Cobra says, one of my favorite lines in the whole movie is, go ahead, I don't shop here.
Yeah.
It's such a great line. There's so many of them throughout this movie. And you see that played out in other movies in the 80s. And I think that Sly really forged ahead with that premise. And the movie's tagline that was on the posters is also uttered here, which is that you're the disease and I'm the cure, which was a crime is the disease and Sly was the cure. So we have a confrontation here where Sly eventually winds up face to face with this guy, and he winds up shooting him and killing him. Sly, of course, says drop it and fires off a few shots before the guy has a chance to actually drop it, which is another setup for you to understand what kind of a character Cobra is. And as he exits the supermarket and winds up getting into a little bit of an altercation verbally with some of the other police officers outside, on the way out, I think one of the reporters, there's some press there, asks him, is this related to the Night Slasher? We haven't had much of an introduction to the Night Slasher yet, but I guess the cult that we saw during the opening sequence of this movie, I guess we're supposed to believe that the Night Slasher has something to do with that cult. And Stallone, which is I thought was a really, really poignant part of this movie, he takes the reporter and he kind of shoves the reporter's face in the corpse of a dead kid that was killed by the killer that we saw inside the supermarket. So do you guys have any thoughts about the wrap-up of the supermarket scene, Craig Cohen?
Yeah, I actually think the one-liners, they serve a great purpose here. And, you know, as you said, they would sort of be co-opted possibly down the line after this, you know, for comedic effect. And I think here it serves two purposes. They're funny. I can't remember. I couldn't even tell you how many times I used the line, go ahead, I don't shop here, ever since I saw Cobra for the first time. But I think it also is a great psychological tool that Cobra's using here to really sort of, you know, dress down this guy and exert his his dominance over him in a situation where Cobra should really feel the one, you know, that doesn't have the upper hand here. But he really doesn't show any fear. And he's openly mocking him over the, you know, over the sound system with an audience, no less. Yeah. So I think that really serves two purposes. And I think here it's incredibly effective. And, you know, as time went on, the one-liners got a little out of hand in action movies. But here it really is the perfect execution. And even the scene afterwards with the reporters where, you know, the reporter says, do you think you used or do you think it was right to use excessive force? And, you know, Cobra says, I used everything I had. And this was really, you know, this was sort of taking Dirty Harry sort of one step further where, you know, you have a cop who's really fed up with the law. And we'll have, you know, a big conversation later on where, you know, Cobra says, you know, we lock him up, but the judges let him go. And, you know, I don't think this movie gets too preachy or it falls too onto, you know, either side of the argument. I don't think it's trying to make any kind of political statement, but I think it's handled really well in that opening scene.
I completely agree. Jeff Ferry, thoughts?
I think that Cobra prefers Old West justice.
Yes.
Where, like,
yes.
A crime is like it. Like if you ever watch like a show like Deadwood or one of those Tombstone type shows, it's like, okay, this person's a criminal. He's killed somebody. He has a gun. I'm going to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. As far as he's concerned, that was justice. And I mean, he does his best. He tries to get the guy to put his gun down at first and before he throws a knife into his chest. And then, like he said, he yells, drop it, bang, 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 and shoots the guy. I just think that's for the witnesses later on, just so they can say, yeah, he said drop it. And, yeah, when they get outside, the reporter who – I love the reporters that are, like, standing inside a crime scene screaming at a cop who just walked outside after shooting somebody, yelling about excessive force. I'm like, the guy had a gun and a grenade. It's not like he shot some unarmed 85-year-old woman.
Yeah.
So as we move on from the pretty effective opening scene of this movie, we see Cobra pulling up to what we assume is his home at this point. It winds up being his home. And there's yet another confrontation here where he's looking for a parking spot and there's not quite enough room for his car to fit in. And he winds up pulling in and pushing another car out of the way to get into a parking spot. Winds up getting into a little bit of a confrontation with the owner of that car, winds up pulling a cigarette out of the guy's mouth and ripping his shirt, which will recur again shortly. We'll see this guy again. Sly moves his way in towards his apartment, and we get to see where Cobra lives. He kind of lives on a beachfront property. He's got a telescope in his window, and he doesn't have a heck of a lot of respect for the newspaper. He kind of throws it into a grill and puts the cover back onto it. We get to see the inside of his apartment. He's got some pretty sophisticated computer equipment for the time. And we find out that he's got some gun cleaning equipment that he keeps in an egg carton inside of his refrigerator. And there, another one of the most popular and famous scenes happens here where Sly pulls out a leftover pizza and cuts off a piece of that pizza with a pair of scissors and begins to eat it. And one of the things that really sticks out to me through this scene as somebody who lived through the 80s is that Sly's got a small television set in the room and there's a Toys R Us television commercial playing on that TV set, which serves as kind of a time capsule to the 1980s. When you watch this film and you see that commercial playing on that small television set, that's something that I remember seeing as a young child back in the 1980s. So we also see right after that commercial is the Night Stalker made the news, and he has struck for the 16th time. And the news report details the fact that he's got no pattern. He's got no typical victim. There's nothing that the police seem to be able to put together that links him in any way to any of these serial crimes. And this is kind of a bit of a foreshadowing that's thrown out in this news report. Then you may not pick up on that unless you're really paying attention. So, Jeff Ferry, thoughts overall on this scene in general?
It's an interesting scene because it's both totally not necessary and absolutely necessary. Like, until the TV comes on, you're not really getting any information that you need,
mm-hmm.
but you're getting a lot of his character again. Again, where you could be told about how crazy he is or what a loner he is. They just show you. He's not afraid of, you know, the guys outside, you know, some possible thugs. And I do like when he goes up, he rips the one guy's shirt. And when he rips the guy's shirt down, you can see the guy's microphone pack underneath. So I wonder if Stallone improvised that little move. But, like, he goes inside, he throws the paper into the grill. Like, he's just doing crazy stuff. You walk inside, he's got the stuff in the fridge. You're like, is this guy insane? Like, he takes the pizza out, and not only does he cut it, he just cuts one little piece off. And then he puts the rest back in the box.
Mm-hmm.
He eats, and he keeps his gloves on.
Yeah, he eats a tiny little slice. So the whole time you're just like, is this person insane? Like, he's living in, like, a parallel dimension. But again, he's not really saying anything when he's in an apartment, but you're getting a ton of information, and then the TV comes on and tells you about the 16 murders in 1 month. That's right. An important piece of thing. Like, that's a lot killing. I mean, you're not taking a lot of days off as a killer there if you're out. I mean, maybe you're not working weekends, but you're basically killing every night.
Great. Craig Cohen.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about the TV, I love the way he turns on the TV. He, like, it's almost like, you know, when you're a kid and you're play fighting with guns and you sort of move your hand to indicate you're shooting. He, like, does that with the remote, which, I don't know, for some reason it cracks me up. And we get the Toys R Us commercial, which is another indicator throughout this movie. There's a couple of instances where we see that it's Christmas time for no particular reason. You know, there's other movies that take place during Christmas that really it factors in. Die Hard, of course, and then like even the first Lethal Weapon movie. But here it's Christmas, and it doesn't mean anything. The other thing that I found interesting about the news report is they're attributing all these murders to the night slasher, but they say he's got no pattern, whereas most serial killers sort of, you know, prey on women or prey on children or you know, some subset of the population. Whereas when the movie goes on, you know, the other cops are less and less prone to believe Cobra when he says that this is, you know, a group of people. It doesn't seem that absurd to think it's a group of people where the only thing tying all these murders together is the type of knife that they use.
Yes. Absolutely. And that leads us perfectly into the next sequence. And we cut to a masked man in a van. I don't know if we're supposed to assume this is the night slasher or not, but we see an unfortunate waitress coming out of a restaurant by herself, strangely. She's locking up. There's nobody else that works there besides her. And we see the back of this truck opens up. And some guys get out, and they're wielding axes and a sledgehammer. So, strangely, you know, in the times that we're living in now, it always seems to be a gun murder. And in this movie, we see guys with physical weapons, so axes and sledgehammers. And then we see this really strange-looking knife come out, which winds up playing a good part in the rest of the movie. It's almost a kind of a combination between a knife and brass knuckles with spikes on them. And, you know, we hear the cop saying that this was some sort of this was the same weapon that was involved in the other murders. I guess they can sort it with forensics. They can understand that this was the same knife that was involved. And we see that Cobra wants to get involved in the case. We find out that his name is actually Cobretti, and he works on the Zombie Squad, which we don't get a lot of background on what the Zombie Squad itself is, but we know that Stallone is part of it. And we also find out that another officer named Monty does not want Cobra on the case. And we sort of get a little bit of insight into the way that Cobra thinks. By some of the things that he says that the killer doesn't follow BS rules. I'm going to remain family friendly here.
Yeah.
He actually says the whole word, but he doesn't follow BS rules. And we also get to see quickly Cobra firing off at the firing range here. So you guys, I'm going to throw to you for some thoughts on this scene. Jeff Ferry.
Well, I do like when the waitress gets taken out. Like, they come up with a sledgehammer, and they're beating up her car and they have an axe. So the cops can tell it's the same knife, but they can't put together the fact that there was more than one person pounding in with a sledgehammer and with an axe. And like, do they think the same person made all that damage? Like, man, this killer's got a real violent streak to him. He kills the person, then he beats their car up. And like, the thing that struck me about the firing range is, like, he gets in an argument in the hallway, and then he walks into, like, the next room, which just happens to be a firing range, and he just walks in and just opens fire down the range. Not like, is anybody down there? Is there even a target? He just starts shooting. Like, you gotta love movie logic. We're like, there's nowhere to sign in. There's just, nah, I'm good. That's why the movie's 84 minutes. There's no fat in this movie.
Craig Cohen.
Yeah, this is really the movie sort of, you know, taking care of any business it has to take care of before it really ramps up and becomes the action film that we're really going to get. And the funny thing about this is you get the reference to Cobra working on the zombie squad, and later on his partner will tell a character that, you know, they're sort of the bottom line. They're the group that handles the business. Nobody else will. And based on this string of murders, you'd think that a guy like Cobra would be the guy that you'd want working this case.
Yeah. No, I agree. So this movie is moving at a really quick pace. The next set of scenes, we see the Night Slasher himself rear-ending another car in order to set up his next murder. And this is in a sort of a seedy area of the city. It's underneath an overpass. And he and some accomplices are kind of setting up this poor girl to be killed by rear-ending her and then jumping out of their car and wind up killing her. And this is where we get introduced to Brigitte Nielsen's character, who just happens to drive by and witness the aftermath of this murder. And she unfortunately winds up slowing down, seeing the Night Slasher's face, who apparently has never been identified by an eyewitness before. So we're assuming that Brigitte is the first person who's actually seen his face. And we see one of the Night Stalker's accomplices is actually a police officer. So we know that he's got some inside sway inside the police department. So the cops, of course, call in Cobra, and he shakes down a few of these sickos that are out in the streets. And we get a little more of an insight into this Monty character, this other police officer, who is the one who's been kind of busting Cobra's balls about his methodology, and comes out saying that he thinks Cobra is going to wind up killing the wrong guy because of his methods are so, I guess, non-police-like. And, you know, we've got a couple of intros or a little more in-depth into a couple of other characters. So we get to see Brigitte herself rolling into the movie. We get to see the Night Stalker, and we get to learn about the Night Stalker's police connection throughout this next sequence. Craig Cohen, any thoughts on that?
Did we get to Sledgehammer yet?
I don't believe so.
Okay. I wasn't sure if we were up to the photo shoot yet or not.
No, but we're not.
This is funny because this is where the movie loses an entire day. You basically go from the waitress murder to the cops talking about the waitress murder to the next night, seemingly, where Brigitte witnesses their next killing, which I always thought was funny that they didn't separate it with any kind of daytime scene. Or is it supposed to be the same night? I don't even know.
I'm not sure on that one.
Yeah. I think these scenes are great, though. I think the terror that the actresses show here and I don't know, the level of violence, for me, it's enough. I don't need to see anymore. The implied terror here, it's a really scary thought, being, you know, out late at night by yourself and being rear-ended and then being attacked. I mean, it's something that I think everybody could, you know, there's nobody that's immune to that, really. And I guess it's just a matter of how you react. But I don't know. The murder scenes were really, really effective for me. And, you know, they bordered on, you know, on disturbing without being incredibly graphic.
Yeah, I agree. These scenes were pretty terrifying. You know, if you put yourself in the place of the poor girl who got rear-ended and wind up being murdered for seemingly no reason, it is a little bit on the creepy side. Jeff Ferry, any thoughts?
Yeah, like if this movie was made today, besides the fact that it'd be 2 hours and 15 minutes long, like those murder scenes, there'd be no implied violence. I mean, you'd see it. I mean, you'd see, depending on who was directing it, you might have like hostile levels of violence.
Mm.
You'd see the people get hacked up in this and that, because that's just, I mean, you don't see too much anymore where like the knife comes up and then it cuts to the next scene. They just don't do that type of thing anymore. But I think you get just as much out of it, if not more, than to see a bunch of splattery blood effects. I mean, like, we all know what happened next.
Mm.
I also liked when Brigitte Nielsen goes by, she sees the night slasher, but she doesn't immediately recognize what happened. She just knows, hey, there's something weird going on. There's this really strange guy with amazing cheekbones standing on the side of the road.
Yes.
But, like, it's only later that they put it together what happened. I'd like that she wasn't like, oh, I just saw a murder. She's just like, oh, there's some creep standing in the road.
Yeah.
That's a great point, and I'm kind of glad you brought that up, because I think that's something that the audience of today should pay attention to, and that is, you don't necessarily see the Night Stalker, or Night Slasher, I'm sorry, slashing up this poor girl. You kind of just see the knife coming towards her, and that's kind of where it cuts out. You know, and it's very particularly effective, and I'm glad that you brought that up, Jeff. So, the next sequence is a montage.
Ah, there we go. Sledgehammer.
Yes, it's a three-way montage. Now, you're seeing three different characters' perspectives through this montage. You're seeing Cobra sweeping the streets, looking for leads. He's kind of shaking different people down. I guess he's following up on people who he knows and trying to get some information. You're also seeing the Night Slasher. He's out on the prowl. He's killing more victims, apparently unabated by the fact that he was just identified. And you're also seeing Brigitte Nielsen's character doing a photo shoot where we see some very interesting robots that she's moving around between and taking some pictures in between. And we see Sly as Cobra shaking down a bunch of different people, shaking down bartenders and different patrons along the way, looking for some answers or any leads that he can find on the Night Slasher or any of his people. And we find out that the Night Slasher himself is actually after Brigitte's character. So he's well aware who she is, and he's tracked her down. And we wind up in a parking deck where after the photo shoot has occurred, she's walking out into this parking deck with another guy who is, you know, trying to get his...
Sledgehammer!
Yeah, he's trying to make his way into her pants and winds up getting taken out by some of these cult members. And the Night Slasher shows up with his van and winds up smashing another guy with the van and gives the order to kill Brigitte. And she winds up actually getting away, and the cops wind up showing up. So we got quite a lot of that goes on during this montage and the aftermath in the parking garage. Any ideas or thoughts on this one, Jeff Ferry?
I'm pretty sure this montage is where they cut about 10 minutes out of the movie. Because you probably had to go through a couple really boring interviews of them trying to shake people down. Where, like, he said he was going to shake people down. I got a couple scenes of it. That's all I needed. And then you get the Brigitte montage just to, like, let you know, hey, here's where she is right now. So that the next scene, you know where she's coming from. And then you see that the Night Slasher is starting to close in on her. And then we get down into the parking garage with Sledgehammer, the greatest actor of all time. And he is in full weasel mode. You know, he's like, hey, you know, you should sleep with me. It's good for your career. You know, it's not that I want you to. It's just good for you. So he's got a sign around his head that's like, I'm going to be dead soon. So, you know, he gets taken out, some other innocent bystander. I did appreciate the security guard. For a movie, he was a damn good security guard. He actually responded to the situation. He shot at the bad guys. He didn't hit anybody. But I thought he gave a noble effort.
He tried.
He was better than, like, a red shirt in, like, a Star Trek show. Like, he at least made some positive moves before he got taken out by a van at 60 miles an hour. But I mean, the scene, it also shows that while she's the damsel in distress, that she's not an idiot. Like, she does get away from the guy before, you know, he has to take off. But I mean, it's a great scene. It sets up the danger. It shows how dangerous he is. She is now in full, you know, I need to go to the cop mode. Again, it's a quick, what's it, 3-4 minute scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got that scene itself has a beginning, middle, end. Boom, you're in and you're out.
This montage had to be like a high five moment, huh? Where they were in the editing room and collectively they probably, you know, Stallone, the director, and maybe the editor figured out a way to make this one super montage, arguably one of the most complex montages in an action film. Mm-hmm. I can imagine them all sort of high-fiving each other after they sort of condensed all this story down into a nice little pocket movie. One thing I wanted to hit on in terms of the garage sequence is we get our first indication of how big of a movie this really was. It had a $25 million budget, which by today's standards isn't a lot. And even if you compare it to some of other Stallone's other movies, this movie, I don't think a lot of people would really think of this as sort of the, you know, the budget crazy movie that it is. But this is a big special effects movie, or at least a big stunt movie. We have a tremendous stunt slash special effect here where the security guard or the cop gets rammed by that van, where it's a side shot and you see the hit on the commentary track, which is worth listening to by George P. Cosmatos. He talks about how they did it, and it's basically a dummy that they had a flash on the gunny he held to make it look like he shot right before he got hit. But that's really the first indication that I think this movie really gets sort of overlooked as sort of a big stunt movie. You've got Terry Leonard, who was the stunt coordinator on this, and there's some great stuff in here. There's some high falls. There's some people that are lit on fire. And then we have the big scene at the end where Stallone and Brigitte are in that pickup truck having that gunfight with the motorcycles. And if you watch that scene, that's all practical stuff going on, and it's amazing. Yes. So I think one thing that this movie really, I think, the general public forgets about in terms of its quote-unquote legacy is just what an amazing stunt movie this is.
Oh, I agree. And that's a great, great thing to point out. And, you know, we're looking at this movie, and it's 2014 now. We're looking at a movie that was made in 1986, and things have changed a lot in the special effects landscape today as opposed to back then. These were not special effects that were generated by computers. This was not CGI special effects. These were actually practical effects that were done via camera trickery and stunts and stunt doubles and people who were actually performing these different acts. And this is a great thing to point out, Craig. I'm really glad that you brought that up. So there's a lot to think about when you're watching this movie. You know, try to appreciate those differences and the time the movie was made in. So in our next set of scenes, we see Brigitte's character is in a hospital type setting. We get introduced to Sergeant Gonzalez, who seems to be maybe Cobra's partner. We're not quite sure, but he does work with Cobra, and they're questioning Brigitte's character to try to figure out if she knows why those killers were chasing after her at her photo shoot. And this is where she connects the dots and remembers seeing the murder, or the aftermath of the murder, rather, underneath the bridge that night when she was driving. And, you know, Cobra himself is pretty concerned about that. And this is where we find out for sure that the Night Stalker has a police accomplice, which is Nancy Stalk, another officer who's kind of outside the room and watching what's going on. And I guess she'll be reporting back to the Night Stalker that this girl, this Brigitte, is definitely IDing him. So she warns the Night Stalker. And I'm not sure if you guys picked up on this that I did, but while Nancy Stalk is talking to the Night Stalker himself, it seems almost like they have some sort of a relationship, if you were. So there, you know, the Night Stalker himself is preparing himself. He's talking to himself in a mirror, and she's kind of behind him, telling him about Brigitte and the fact that he has to take her out because she can ID him. And she's kind of getting kind of touchy-feely with him at the same time. This is the same set of sequences where we see the Night Stalker combing his hair with his weird black goop in a dirty sink, kind of setting up the fact that he's maybe not the cleanest of people. But Nancy Stalk says that Brigitte is going to ruin their new world. So we're getting a little bit of an insight into the fact that maybe this cult is looking to alter things in their own paradigm. So Craig Cohen, thoughts on this?
I really like the fact that the Night Slasher groupie is the woman that they cast in the role, because we talk about movies being made today versus being made, you know, in the 80s. This is a character that if it was today, it would probably be some hot, young, in-demand actress. Whereas here you've got like this, you know, bordering on middle age, you know, schlubby looking woman, which is really probably the type of woman that the Night Slasher would attract. So I actually think that dynamic is great, especially when she's talking to him and she's sort of kneeling next to him and she's rubbing like her lip on his bicep and he like cuts his finger. There's some really weird stuff going on there. And as much as I think the longer version of this movie is probably really, really interesting, I think this sort of condensed version, this, you know, this 86 minute version that we get is really great because it creates all of these weird questions that never really get answered.
Yeah, it leaves a lot of stuff to the viewer's imagination. So you have a lot of things that you can mull over in your own mind as you're watching the movie. Jeff Ferry, any thoughts?
Yeah, Stalk is very, you just want to strangle her every time she's on screen, which is the mark of a great villain. You also want to ask her why she's wearing a fright wig most of the time. Because, I mean, I realize it was the 80s. It was a tough time for everybody. But, like, even for the 80s, she has a bad do going on there. It's, I mean, it's just terrible. And, yeah, her scene with the Night Slasher is just, like, it goes from like, oh, okay, I see what's going on here, to like, okay, these two are really starting to creep me out now. I do not like this relationship at all. These two are creepy, which is good because they're the bad guys. Also, I think when is he putting the stuff in his hair? Is he trying to dye his hair?
Yeah.
Listen, there are some faces that cannot be hidden with some hair dye. Like if Danny Trejo dyed his hair blonde. Right. Still Danny Trejo.
But he puts the glasses on.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. He's also like 6'6". You know, he's like a bodybuilder. Like, they couldn't send some of their goon squad up there. They got to send him.
Do we want to talk about Brian Thompson real quick, the Night Slasher?
Sure.
I think he is so great. You know, Jeff Ferry just did a great job describing him. He has such a unique look, and it's really kind of surprising that he didn't sort of take off or even get his own sort of, you know, vehicles, you know, sort of like, you know, maybe the career that Dolph went on to have after playing a Stallone villain. I was actually flipping channels the other day and I came across Joe Dirt and he plays in that. He does a riff. They do a riff on The Silence of the Lambs and he's playing the Buffalo Bill character. And it was just really kind of sad to see him in that role, knowing how frightening he could really be. And, you know, it's great seeing him get a paycheck, and it was interesting to see him do comedy. But I kind of feel like his career probably didn't really go the way it could have or should have.
Yeah, I always remember him from The X-Files. He showed up on a couple episodes. I feel like it was early in the run when I was still watching. He was playing an alien, of course, because look at him. But like, so when he showed up in Cobra, I hadn't seen it in a while. I'm like, where do I recognize this guy from? And I flipped through his IMDb, which, like you said, is not very long. And I'm like, that's what it is. He's the X-Files alien. I can't believe he didn't show up for. I mean, he could have been a go-to goon for years after this.
Oh, totally.
Like,
oh,
give us a big guy with a, you know, just a face made to like be a bad guy. And maybe he's just one of those guys that wasn't into the acting thing and just did it when he felt like.
And actually, I'm looking here, Jeff, and you might have nodded agreement when I was going the flipping channels route. he's played since the mid 80s various Klingons in four different Star Trek series.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up, and he's also got a commercial spot that I believe is in national rotation in the U.S. currently in present day, and he's pretty recognizable in that. So he's been around, but he hasn't really, as Jeff Ferry said, he's got that recognizable villain face, and I would have thought that he would have been perfectly typecast as that villain character, that hulking silent villain character, you know, between Cobra and today. But unfortunately, it didn't seem to work out that way. But he has been in that Klingon garb, and he's currently around today in a national commercial spot. I believe it's for some sort of an insurance company.
I'm going to have to keep my eyes peeled for that. I tend to do a lot of channel surfing when commercials come on. So maybe next time I'll sit tight and hope to see Brian Thompson.
Yeah, hopefully next time I see it, I'll try to DVR it and we can talk about it on a later episode.
Cool.
So the next sequence of scenes is we see Sly pulling up back to his home. Brigitte's character is back in the hospital still. And I assume that Sly figures that his partner, Gonzalez, is back in the hotel keeping an eye on her, and he's gone home. And this is where we see the same guys that Sly had the altercation with the first time that he was home and he wound up ripping the guy's shirt. Now they seem to be all buddy-buddy, and they allow Cobra to park in his spot. And we get to see Cobra using this computer equipment that I guess at the time in 1986 was pretty state-of-the-art. Today looks a little bit dated, so he's got some monitors. There's some really small monitors there and some keyboards. And he's going through some mug shots, looking at some criminals, I guess trying to pinpoint who the Night Slasher and his accomplices might be. And we get a little more product placement. There's a giant neon Pepsi sign outside the window. And we get to see the Night Slasher dressed up as a janitor moving through the hospital, this very, I guess, technically advanced and more modern hospital back in 1986. Looks a little bit dated now. We see the Night Stalker killing a janitor, taking his uniform, and he winds up moving his way through the hospital. We think that he may wind up killing a nurse in an elevator, but he doesn't.
That was great. He was supposed to use the service elevator or the stairs, which
yes,
I love. She keeps giving him a hard time to the point where he starts to pull his knife out.
Yes.
You feel really, really nervous for this woman who's just sort of following the health code.
Yeah. I'll let you guys talk a little bit more about that when we get through with the rest of this this scene. And we see the Night Slasher winds up finding Brigitte, and they get into a little bit of a chase scene where the Night Slasher finds her sort of sleeping in her bed. She winds up getting away. She's trapped in a bathroom, and the Night Slasher does his best psycho impression, stabbing his knife through the doorway. And by this time this is all happening, Sly is figuring out that there's been some sort of a ruse to get him and Gonzalez out of the hospital and leave Brigitte unprotected. So, Jeff Ferry, any thoughts on the sequence and the ruse to get Gonzalez and Sly out of the hospital?
I'm always amazed when the cops fall for this trick, which they do in every movie, that like they get a call from, you know, the police department. It's like, oh, just leave that person you're guarding with your life, just unguarded. Yeah. Come back, you're fine. And I mean, it always works. And it's just dumb luck that Stallone happens to call and is like, uh-oh. And of course, somehow Stallone's the first one there. I guess there's no other officers that can respond that are closer. But again, while it's dumb luck that she doesn't get killed at first because he stabs the empty bed, like, she makes a pretty good go of it. She's trying to hide in the bathroom and he's trying to knock down the door. Thankfully, she's in the one hospital where they have true wooden doors that aren't made of like particle board that like he could kick through in one kick. And back to the elevator, I mean, it just proves that no matter how sharp your knife is, you cannot kill a sassy black woman on an elevator.
Oh, great stuff, Craig Cohen.
I really, really like this sequence. This is another sequence that I think really benefits from the editing, where you've got Cobra getting the phone call where his partner says, "I'm in your office." And, you know, Cobra says, "What are you doing there? You're supposed to be at the hospital." And he says, "I got a call to, you know, say I meet you there." And then you've got this sort of intercutting from Cobra leaving his apartment where he gets attacked himself. And we have that whole sequence before he even makes it to the hospital. And then to see, you know, Brigitte sort of, you know, fending for herself before yelling in the empty hallways, which doesn't seem to get anybody's attention until she pulls the fire alarm. And then everybody and their mother sort of comes out, which I thought was pretty, pretty funny. But a really effective scene. And I think it's another really well done sequence in this movie.
I agree. There's a lot of great action in this. A lot of great tension as Brigitte's getting chased down by the Night Slasher. And we see the Night Slasher himself actually doing his own dirty work. As, you know, we've seen prior, he's saying his lesser henchmen to do this work. And this time he's kind of taking matters into his own hands and kind of chased Brigitte down himself. And the next set of scenes, we see Cobra getting reprimanded. And Cobra himself, he seems to know, he has some sort of an insight. You know, the work that he's done in the past has led him to believe that the Night Slasher has someone on the inside, but there's no proof of that. And he's arguing his own case against this Monty character we've seen prior in a couple of different scenes. And this Monty guy has another chip on his shoulder again, even more of a chip now that this incident has taken place. And, you know, we get a little bit of an altercation between Monty and Cobra. And we decide that they have to move Brigitte's character to a safer place. And that leads into the big car chase in this movie where, you know, Sly's got Brigitte in his pretty awesome vehicle that we've discussed before.
The Mercury, yeah.
Yes, the Mercury. And they're being chased down by the Night Slasher and his seemingly endless supply of lackeys who are willing to do anything to see her dead and Sly dead. And, you know, they are being chased through the city. A lot of destruction happens and a lot of explosions and different stunts happen. And Sly winds up losing his beloved car. So I don't want to go too much into this because I know you guys probably have a lot to say about this. Craig Cohen, we'll throw to you first.
This is another great example of the excellent stunt work in this movie. You have a really, really great car chase that you can tell a lot of thought was put into. And it's just really always gratifying to see a well thought out, well executed, well shot, well produced action scenes in movies. And I think this car chase really has it all. And you got the, you know, it sort of ends with that beautiful Mercury, you know, launching and getting a little banged up.
Yeah, it's a shame to see such a beautiful vehicle being destroyed in such a way.
Yeah, actually, if you go to Planet Hollywood in Times Square, you can see the front end of a Mercury. I'm not sure which car in the movie it was. I know the main car was Stallone's own car. They made some repros for the action scenes. But if you go into Times Square, Planet Hollywood, it's right over one of the doorways you go through. It's there hanging from the ceiling. It's pretty neat.
Oh, awesome. Next time I'm up in New York City, I'm going to take a look. Jeff Ferry, any thoughts?
Well, like you guys were saying, at this point of the movie, you're starting to wonder exactly how many people does the Night Slasher have access to? Because he seems to be able to, like, even though he's taken a few things himself, like going after Brigitte Nielsen, like right here he's able to call in a few cars for the car chase, and later on we're able to see he seems to have an endless supply of motorcyclists that he can call on if he needs to. But like you said, it's a good, solid car chase, and the thing that actually surprised me the most about it was they were willing to, like, really bang his car up and put it out of commission. Like, I thought they would have movie plot armor where there'd be no way to damage the Mercury. You know, where you see it go off, like, you know, you've seen cars and go off a 60-foot cliff and land, and you see it get all smashed up, and the next scene it just drives away.
Yeah.
Oh, I agree. You know, I think the thing that his car in this, the Mercury, screams custom, And it was pretty amazing that they wound up sacrificing the car this early in the movie, because there was a lot of movie left, and we have another car pursual chase going on after this. And we see that the next set of scenes, we see that Sly is once again getting reprimanded. And once again, Cobra is showing his knowledge and his experience by saying that they're up against some sort of an army. This is not just one guy. And, you know, the rest of the police force seems to be doubting him. We've got more friction between this Monty character and Cobra himself. But they set up yet another convoy. And they're determined to get Brigitte upstate and away from this scenario and out of the reach of the Night Stalker. And we get a little bit of almost a political commentary here during this drive, where Brigitte's character is, questioning why the cops just can't get these criminals and put them away. And Cobra says, you know what, ask the judge, because we put these people in jail and the judge seems to just let them go on these light sentences and not put them away for the terms they need to be put away. And we get a little bit of an insight into why Cobra is doing what he's doing, but he also at the same time feels hamstrung by the justice system that he introduces these criminals into once he catches them. We get a little more of a description of what the zombie squad is. Gonzalez explains that the zombie squad is the bottom line. It's the last bastion of hope that the police department or the government has against these really depraved criminals. And we also get to learn that Cobra's real name is Marion. Marion Cobretti. So, and we kind of get the joke that Sly wanted to have a tough name like Alice, a little bit of a humor introduced into this sequence of scenes. Jeff Ferry, any thoughts on this sequence?
Well, you get a little bit more of a, like, this is right when they're trying to head out and they're trying to figure out what their next move is going to be. You get a little bit more of a Gonzalez who, although he plays a small role in this movie, I really enjoy him.
That was Poppy from Seinfeld, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they play him so well. He's not like he's a very minor role. He's not an equal partner at all in it. But he's just like, no matter what happens, he's just always there. He's like, yeah, I got your back. Whatever crazy thing you're gonna come up with. And all they do is boss each other stones. Like there's no backstory, but you totally buy. Oh yeah, these guys are partners and friends. You know, Stallone's always ripping him about eating candy and sugary food and stuff. Just, it's the minor touches he put in that, like, really keeps the film going. Because, I mean, deep down, it's a very simple plot. So you need, like, these little extra things to, fill it out a little bit. And, as usual, Stallone has given his character a very interesting name besides the whole Cobra Cobretti thing. Of course, he's got to have Marion as a first name. I mean, I think he spends as much time trying to come up with character names as he does plot sometimes.
Can you imagine the notebook he probably has full of names that he hasn't used yet?
Oh, yeah. Names with just crazy, he's like, oh, this guy's name is – I want this guy to be named Spike, but I got to come up with some crazy last name that kind of goes with it, or some reason he's named Spike. Oh, yeah. I think he spends much time doing that. And then, the script's due the next day and he has to write the whole plot out.
And imagine we almost got Alex Cobretti when this was originally – being planned as Beverly Hills Cop, and then there was all kinds of differences of opinion about which way they should go, and thankfully Stallone moved on and did Cobra, and we got the wonderful, wonderful Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy.
It's unbelievable these both came from the same germ of an idea. Is there two movies that are any further apart? I mean, I guess I could somehow buy that Fair Game garbage came from this. But it's impossible to believe that Beverly Hills Cop, okay, switch those two, put Eddie Murphy in this movie and put Stallone in that movie. It's insanity on both sides. It wouldn't make any sense.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting that everybody involved knew enough that they weren't on the same page and all decided to sort of just move on, where you had Stallone trying to really shoehorn in all these Cobra ideas into the concept that was Beverly Hills Cop. And it's one of those projects, there's a lot of projects out there where people say, oh, what could have been? And this is one of those projects where I think a lot of people say, well, thank God.
Yeah. I just see Stallone go, just put a banana in your tailpipe.
But this sequence in general, I feel, is one of those sequences that really works. Like Jeff Ferry, you said, you know, it's a little bit of character building. And I think this really sort of helps the relationship that's developing between Ingrid, the Brigitte Nielsen character, and Cobra. And I think it's organic and it's natural, and it actually feels like two people getting to know each other. And Gonzalez sort of, you know, dropping the name, you know, to give her to tease him with, I think is really cool. And I think this is a really sort of nice little, not filler scene, but it's a nice scene for us to catch our breath before we really get down to the, you know, the explosive finale of this movie.
Oh, yeah, totally. Great observations from both of you. And as we roll into the next short sequence, we see they're in the midst of driving upstate, and they wind up, the convoy winds up stopping for food. And this is kind of more of a character development and foreshadowing sequence. We see Cobra pulling his best Fonzie impression on the jukebox. We find out that a little bit more about Cobra's health kick, where he's taking issue with Ingrid, or Brigitte's character, putting a lot of ketchup on her French fries. And more importantly, we get the reveal that, you know, Sly, Cobra's character, catches Nancy Stalk on a payphone outside. And, you know, he sort of lets her off easy and accepts her explanation for being on the phone. But he knows something is up.
Is that the first time we see that she's with them?
When they were getting ready to leave, you saw her with them.
Yeah.
It just seems like such a weird choice that they sent her. Unless they were like, oh, you know, they're watching a woman, so we need to send a woman along.
I'm sure there was probably dialogue in there for that. They were like, screw it, cut it out.
Yeah, this is probably some of the stuff that got cut out of that initial work print that that you've referenced before. But we wind up seeing the cult mobilizing, and we get the buildup that something's going to happen very, very soon. And we also get the indication that Brigitte or Ingrid wants to have some sort of a romantic relationship with Cobra, as she states that she wants to see him after this is all over. We get a little bit of a makeout scene before the introduction of the final confrontation. So, Jeff Ferry, thoughts on that small sequence?
I would say this is the only sequence in the film that keeps this from being a true 80s movie, because, like, they have possibly the tamest makeout session ever, maybe the tamest makeout since Rhinestone. And then it cuts, like, if this movie was A, made today, or B, didn't star Sylvester Stallone in 1986, that would have been a full-on sex scene with 80s boobs. But Stallone was probably like, listen, I don't have time for any of that. If we cut, if we do 3 minutes of a sex scene, that's 3 minutes of people falling off motorcycles I'm not going to be able to film. So, you know, let's, again, it's like the violence. It's like you're just implied. Yeah, they kissed. It's the next day. Guess what, folks? They had sex last night.
It's funny, though, because a couple of years later, he would embrace that in The Specialist, where you have that amazing shower scene between him and Sharon Stone.
Well, I think at that point in the 90s, if you had Sharon Stone in your movie, I think it was in her contract. Thing, wasn't it? Yes.
So the only thing I think you guys didn't talk about that I'll mention is the corny little joke Cobra uses when Ingrid is putting ketchup on her fries, and she's seemingly doing it for 2 minutes. And he says, do you have a life preserver, because you're drowning those fries in ketchup?
Yeah, I think that kind of dovetails into the earlier confrontation he had with Gonzalez, who's apparently an unhealthy eater. And Cobra was giving him a little bit of a talking to about his eating habits and suggesting some healthier options. And
yeah, I think we see Cobra eat two things in this movie. The pizza with the scissors, which I don't think anybody would argue. I guess the portion of pizza that he ate is probably in line with whatever his daily requirement is. But it's not the best thing he could be eating.
Yeah.
And then we see him eating an apple. I think those are the only two things we ever see him eat.
I think you're right on that.
Yeah, possibly at the hospital when they're going through the food that she's done with. And I think he's more scavenging through it for Gonzalez.
Yeah, yeah, that was kind of a funny little aside. They were kind of discussing what they were going to do with her leftover food that she didn't eat. So the following morning, everybody is sort of emerging from their cabins, and we get the expose that Nancy Stalk has sort of vanished, and that pretty much exposes her. We know that Cobra was on to her already, but Gonzalez kind of is clued into the fact that Nancy Stalk, the fellow police officer, is actually working for the opposite side, just in time for the thugs themselves to pull up on their motorcycles, and we get a firefight that ensues, and we got a lot of gunplay, a lot of shooting through some walls of some cabins, and we learn that the Cobra has got some grenades that he's throwing, and we're seeing some motorcycles being blown up, and a lot of special effects and stunts are going on throughout this scene. And towards the end of it, we wind up seeing that Brigitte and Sly are getting away from the cult themselves, and the Slasher is pursuing them into some sort of a grove. And this is a pretty action-packed sequence, a little bit different than what we've seen in the prior scenes in this movie. We've had a car chase and some other action scenes in a parking garage, but this is more of a gunfight at a group of cabins that were set up as a motel. So, Craig Cohen, any thoughts on the action that goes on?
This is really an all-purpose action movie, and this is another thing that I think maybe sort of gets overlooked with this movie is, as you referenced, we've had car chases, we had that sort of garage sequence, and now before we get our big motorcycle chase and then the factory sequence, we've got this hotel ambush or this motel ambush, and you've got like what are going to be three action sequences sort of stacked together. And this is really the part of the movie where it's probably, 12 or 14 minutes where you really don't have time to take a breath. I mean, it's such a great climax to a film. And like I said, most films would choose one of these sequences and say, well, that's it. We're going to do our last stand at the motel. Or they're going to leave the motel and they're going to have the motorcycle chase. Or they're going to end up at this factory. But I think this movie is really, really great for the fact that they did all three.
Agreed, Jeff Ferry?
Yeah, up till now, although there's been a lot of action in this movie, it's all been, I hate to say small, but like the scene in the store, the original getaway part where they're having the car chase, the stalking in the hospital, like that's stuff you see in like this. That's like almost like a drama type thing. And then, like you said, it gets to this part, and then now it's like the OK Corral with motorcycles. And it's just an insane, like you said, it's like just like a 12-minute, they have the shootout at the motel, which goes right into an insane car chase. And then they end up in the factory, which I can only assume is the same factory where the T2 ends up in Terminator. Yeah. Because, you know, those factories are always around in movies. I've never seen one of these factories where all they seem to do is have fire inside of them. Like, I don't know what they make there. They just need a lot of fire. But in movie world, there's one every three blocks. And they're always open and you can get inside.
And no one's ever working inside them.
And no one's ever there. In T2, the employees are there, but they all get away within 5 seconds. Like, nobody tries to stop these two maniacs to come inside. You know, there's no police response to this gun battle that's going on. But I mean, for the shootout at the actual motel section, I really enjoy that shootout. I kind of wish, like, they made a big deal out of Cobra starting to figure out that he was on the stalk. I almost wish that he'd have figured it out sooner, and like he would have almost been more prepared. I mean, he was prepared; he had his guns and stuff. But I wish almost he would have set a trap for them when they showed up, and just make him like a little bit even more ahead of the game instead of like, oh crap, they're here. Like, we're totally surrounded. Like, I would have liked them to bust into a hotel room, and he's not in there. He's waiting in another motel room, and, you know, takes them by surprise. That would also help to explain how he's able to take out, like, 30 guys by himself.
Well, it did seem like he had the more advanced firepower here, right?
Well, because, I mean, he had his grenades and his Uzi all standard police issue. But, I guess maybe the zombie squad gets these type of things. He was a good shot with them grenades, too. He was throwing them at people on a motorcycle at 35 miles an hour, hitting them.
Yeah, well, and the thing I love about it is ultimately his superiors decide to sort of acquiesce to him and have him take Ingrid out of the city and up into protective custody upstate, mainly to get this war that they know is coming off their streets, you know, because they say, well, Cobra's involved. Eventually, it's going to become a war where he gets all of his toys out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that totally completely plays out. And I'm glad you guys really delved into this whole factory aspect of the next set of scenes. And this was the one thing that I always scratched my head about this movie. And as much as I love it, and you see a sequence where Brigitte and Stallone and some pursuers are running through some sort of a grove, a citrus grove. I'm not sure if it's oranges or whatnot, but they're running through some sort of a grove. We see a lot of trees and produce growing there, and all of a sudden they wind up in a factory that seems to have absolutely nothing to do with processing produce. I mean, you don't need liquid hot magma and hooks that are flying around to process oranges, right? So that was the one thing that kind of threw me off. But at any rate, Brigitte's character winds up being pursued into some sort of a factory or a plant scenario, obviously similar to Terminator 2. She's running around. There's a lot of things that happen here with the thugs or the lackeys of the Night Slasher running around, kind of getting shot down by Stallone. Nancy Stalk herself is there as well as the Night Slasher. And this leads up to the final confrontation where the Slasher himself winds up getting some of his greatest dialogue in the entire movie. And there are some really great one-liners that I know Craig Cohen and I have thrown back and forth between ourselves for many years. We get to the point where the final confrontation happens, and the Slasher and Cobra are having some discussion back and forth between them. And the Slasher himself lets loose some lines along the lines of, let's bleed, pig. I want your eyes, pig. Want to go to hell, pig. And we get a little tiny bit of insight into what the cult was really about when the Night Slasher is talking about their hunters, and they kill the weak so that the strong survive, and they're going to be the future. So we sort of get a little bit of insight near the end as to what the cult's original aim was this entire time. And, you know, several things happen. Cobra winds up prevailing over the Night Slasher and winds up hanging him on a hook that goes through some sort of a big fiery foundry-type demise and giving him a burning, horrible, flesh-charring end that he so deserved.
Yeah.
Craig Cohen, since you're laughing, I'll throw it to you first.
Well, I love before their sort of final hand-to-hand combat, the Night Slasher says, this is where you arrest me, you bring me in. The court is civilized, isn't it, Peg? And he said, they'll say I'm insane. Not that he's afraid of Cobra, but he's sort of taking amusement in the fact that Cobra's hands are tied. And then, in reference to being told that the court is civilized, Cobra says, but I'm not. This is where the law stops and I start.
Yes.
And then you've got that great pause. And then he says, sucker, which is said with such, he almost downplays the sucker, where a lot of people would have went really hard with it. It's almost to the point where you have to reverse it and say, did he say sucker? Just such a subtle little moment there that I love so much. And the hook gag is great because you see it coming, and Thompson sells it so well with sort of that guttural cry that he lets out hanging on the hook. Just all around, a real evil guy getting what you want to see him get. And it's really cool to, get the ending where you don't get like the Gonzalez running in saying, oh, don't do it, man. He's not worth it type of ending.
Yeah, I agree. You get a mano with a great payoff for the viewer. And the Night Slasher doesn't wind up getting taken into custody. He winds up getting killed, and he gets the end that he deserves. Jeff Ferry, what are your thoughts on that?
I also think that if what we didn't mention was Stalk has the horror movie thing where she we think she's dead and she just jumps out in the last scene.
Yeah.
And she jumps onto Cobra. If she doesn't do that, I'm pretty sure he's just going to execute that guy.
Oh, totally. She saved him a lot of paperwork, probably.
Yeah. Like, he was just going to have to explain later, like, he was going to go pick up another gun and put it by that guy's hand and be like, yeah, he was about to shoot me. So, like, that guy was not getting out of there alive. He would have been a lot better off if she didn't do that. Because at least he wouldn't have gotten charbroiled then.
Great. Great stuff. So this brings us to the final closing sequence of the movie, almost an epilogue where, you know, we've got the resolution. The Night Slasher himself is dead. I guess the cult itself is now going to fall apart because they have no leader. Nancy Stalk has met her own demise, so she's gotten what she deserves as well. And we find out that Sergeant Gonzalez himself was not, in fact, killed in the earlier gunplay. He's still alive. And still the same guy as he's requesting his gummy bears that he was looking for earlier. So he's hasn't learned the error of his poor eating ways. Cobra is offered a transfer out of the zombie squad, but of course he refuses and asks for his car to be replaced. But of course, this is the police force and the budget can't support that request. So unfortunately, poor Cobra has lost his car, but it is worth it. Because he rides off into the sunset with Brigitte Nielsen. So he gets the girl in the end in exchange for his really badass car.
Not before knocking out Monty.
I was leaving that for you guys to cover. So I'm going to let Jeff Ferry have his way in on the knocking out of Monty first.
I mean, as much as Monty deserved a good punch in the face, it did seem a little odd. Like, he was kind of a jerk the whole movie, but he never really stood in Cobra's way at any point. He just kind of was annoying. But I mean, I guess he's basically got away with murder in this movie and like mayhem at every step. I mean, what's punching out a detective at this point?
For me, it's kind of the way he keeps saying, he like bookends his comments with no hard feelings, right?
Yeah.
Almost like, I know I've been kind of rude to you and I've talked down to you. But at the end of the day, you did things your way. They're not the way I would have done them. No hard feelings. It's almost like saying, I'm going to put you down, but I'm going to sort of apologize at the end in a kind of a rude way so it's all okay. So I think a nice, hard, firm handshake where maybe he pulled him in and said you're welcome might have been cool. But I think for this movie and for this audience – him slugging him after the handshake, it works for this movie.
Absolutely. And the fact that that's immediately followed up by Sly riding off into the sunset with the girl, it kind of solidifies his badassness. And, you know, he's not taking any crap from Monty. Monty got his comeuppance at the end for doubting Sly the whole time and sort of trying to obstruct his vigilante type justice. So Sly gets the upper hand at the end and winds up taking the chick towards the end of the movie. So that brings us to the end of Cobra. And I mean, I've already tipped my hand. Craig tipped my hand very early on in this episode and let everybody know this is one of my favorite Stallone movies. And for obvious reason, I think that this movie sets up a lot of action movies that happen after this, and I think it sets the stage very well. It sets up the dark anti-hero that spouts off a lot of one-liners that you probably shouldn't like, but you do like. You know, he does a lot of things his own way. He doesn't necessarily follow the law. He almost takes on a vigilante persona, and you know, he takes out the bad guys in a way that the regular cops can't. So very well played, in my opinion, by Stallone. I think he did a great job writing this movie. The only thing that I would say going out of this movie is that I really wish that there was more of an exploration into the cult and the New World Order and a little better understanding of why they were doing what they were doing, you know, coming out of this film. I think they cut maybe a little too much of that out. I'm sure much more of that was included in the original cut. So you guys, any ideas or closing thoughts on Cobra, Craig Cohen?
I think we're going to have to get our hands on this this rough cut or this work print or whatever it is. I know it's out there, and I know I was talking to Matt from Rambo Mania the other day about that cut, and it seems like it's definitely a something that we can get our hands on, and maybe we'll devote an episode to that sometime down the road. One thing I wanted to hit on is something we didn't really talk about too much. It's the music in this movie, and I think you've got an interesting blending of this score by Sylvester LeVay, which to me kind of really feels like something John Carpenter would do. It's got that sort of synth feel to it, and it's really effective at parts, but then you've also got these really great sort of pop rock songs from the time period. You've got the John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band song Voice of America's Sons. You got the Jean Bouvier song Feel the Heat. And then you've also got Suave by Miami Sound Machine, and then the excellent Angel of the City by Robert Tepper. So in addition to being a really great action movie, it's another really great score in a long line of Stallone movies that have great scores and soundtracks.
Jeff Perry.
I mean, it's obviously an excellent movie. And like you said, I don't know that I would need the extra 40 minutes that they claim was cut out of this. But I think an extra, it's at like 80, you know, 83, 84, 85 minutes. Like another 5 minutes probably would have been all I needed. Like one more scene with the gang to figure out what's going on. Because, I mean, the movie's almost over and you're still trying to piece together exactly what the gang was up to and what the night slasher was all about. Like, it's almost not until his final thing when he starts screaming at Stallone that you're like, oh, is that what you guys were? You were like a survival of the fittest type thing? But like that's minute 79 when you're finding out that information. But I mean, even that's like a minor thing, and that's something you probably don't even catch till your second or third viewing. Up until then, you're just like, oh, there's a lot going on. There's motorcycles blowing up and people getting set on fire and somebody's eating a pizza with scissors.
Oh man, guys, you know, thanks for letting me, you know, walk us through this movie. This particular film begins my love affair with this late 80s Stallone action movie period, and is the non-Rocky, non-Rambo period that I'm very, very fond of. And I hope that in the future you may let me run through some of the other movies that are coming up that I am quite fond of.
Definitely. You did a tremendous job, Jeff. Thank you for doing the heavy lifting, if you will.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Craig.
Yeah, and please let us know what you think of or thought of our Cobra discussion over on the Facebook group or over on Twitter. And both those links will be in our show notes. And I guess, guys, next episode, we're going to be talking about, I think the next film in the running order is Over the Top.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait.
So we have that to look forward to. And I guess, Jeff Ferry, any closing thoughts?
No, I don't think so.
Well, I do know that since we last talked, you published a book.
I certainly have. I managed to write my 300-page magnum opus, as it was.
Awesome, awesome. Tell us all about it.
It's called The Dawn of Mars. It's a science fiction, action-y type story. It takes place on Mars, obviously. It's a lot of action, and it's only 300 pages. So if you're like me and you've been trying to knock out those you know, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, 1,200 pagers,
yeah,
it's a nice change of pace. 300 pages, you can knock it out in the weekend.
Awesome, awesome. And where can people find it?
It's on Amazon. If you get the paperback version, it's about $8-$9, depending on Amazon. Or you can get the Kindle version for $3.
Oh, sweet, sweet. So it's called The Dawn of Mars by Jeff Ferry.
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, one of the members of this podcast managed to make a cameo in the story.
Ah. So now we're definitely going to have to read it.
Yes.
Awesome. Very cool. So, So if you're into science fiction or interested in stuff that the host of this podcast do in their spare time when they're not doing Slycast, please check out Jeff's book. It sounds really exciting. Jeff Hewlett.
You know, thanks to everybody who has provided us feedback on this show, and I've been very humbled by how well this show has been received by the Stallone fan community out there. And, you know, it's been very, very, very heartening to me to see some of the feedback we've gotten and some of the interaction that we've had with some of our fans out there. So thanks, everybody who's listening to this show. I really, really, really appreciate it.
Right on. We do appreciate it. And we appreciate you coming back and listening to us every month or so. You know, sometimes it's a little bit more than a month, but we are doing this show for an audience that really, really enjoys it, and that makes it all the more gratifying. So that brings us to the end of another installment of Slycast, the Sylvester Stallone fan podcast, and we'll see you next time.